Part 6. Final Acts. Chapter 18. Dispersions. By 1950, 20 years after the final Brussels conference, Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen was at the centre of the world's physics research. Despite his victory over Einstein in 1930, the towering Dane had managed to avoid the lure of dogmatism, and his broad-mindedness had attracted some of the brightest new minds. Young people from Harvard, Caltech, and Cambridge eagerly went to Copenhagen for a year or two during their graduate studies or after to join in the exciting atmosphere and share ideas with the respected, approachable Professor Bohr. Conversations with him demanded as much concentration as ever, for Bohr's accent still rarely strayed far from Danish, no matter what language he tried to speak. But that didn't matter. The bright young people at the Institute came from so many countries that they happily described its official language as broken English. Bohr was a hero in his own country. After the outbreak of World War II, he'd kept the Institute operating during the first years of the German occupation, staying until 1943 before being spirited off by secret RAF transport from Sweden when his Jewish ancestry and political significance made staying any longer too dangerous. Excessively tall and excessively polite, Bohr had nearly died during the RAF flight, for he'd been secreted away in the bomb bay and was supposed to speak into a microphone to tell the pilots if anything was wrong. When his oxygen failed, the mask not fitting around his head, his mutterings and polite gasps seemed no less incomprehensible than his previous communications, and he fell unconscious, only recovering when the pilots, realizing it was odd that there was such silence, swooped lower into denser atmosphere, where there was enough oxygen to keep Bohr alive. Brought in to aid the Manhattan Project in building an atomic bomb, Bohr had tried, albeit unsuccessfully, to alert both Churchill and Roosevelt to the dangers this weapon posed. He suggested there should be a demonstration of it first, or arrangements set up for international control, but to no avail. When the United States dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in the final days of the war, it was the first time the world had been treated to a public showing of these terrible machines. Weapons that had been born, ultimately, in the theories of Einstein as much as in the practical efforts of Bohr and many others. Bohr always felt, as he once put it, that we should be both spectators and actors in the great drama of life. With the support of his thoughtful wife, the openness of his personality, and the general safety of Denmark, he'd managed to be both an onlooker and a participant, in politics as well as in science, all while keeping in line with Europe's noblest ideals. He emerged from the conflict not only unscathed, but stronger in his public standing, at least, than ever before. The German physicist Werner Heisenberg, by contrast, had disgraced himself during the war. More worldly physicists had sometimes teased him for his years of rambling over the countryside with exuberant youth groups, but those hikes hadn't been as innocuous as they'd seemed. Ever more of their participants felt this was a way to get close to the fatherland's soil and to help preserve it from dangerous outsiders such as Jews and foreigners. Although Heisenberg did try to stand up for a few of his colleagues who were being ousted from their academic positions for being Jewish, later he clearly relished being brought into commanding positions within the technocratic parts of the new Nazi state. There were new research groups to run, large budgets to control, and visions of a miracle weapon that could ensure Germany's triumph over its enemies forever. At one point during the war, with black-jacketed SS officers not far away, Heisenberg had even stormed into Bohr's Institute in Copenhagen, explaining with great assurance, now, in these early days when Germany was on the rise, on which side the future lay. Bohr was still there, and he was appalled. Already he'd begun preparing the Institute against German depredations, including hiding the gold Nobel Prizes of two Jewish members. By German law, what was owned by Jews could be stolen, and if the owners tried to keep their possessions, such as by shipping the medals abroad, they, or anyone who helped them, could be arrested and quite legally tortured. Bohr's ingenious friend de Hevesy from their Manchester days, now in Copenhagen, had worked out the ideal hiding place. The lustrous gold medals were dissolved in a mixture of nitric and hydrochloric acids, creating an innocuous brown sludge that was stored on a back shelf until the war was over. That was the German state the excited Heisenberg now so happily represented. His brilliance in creating the uncertainty principle had given him the respect within the Nazi establishment to do almost whatever he wanted. Bohr didn't know that Heisenberg would soon be working female slaves to death at the Sachsenhausen concentration camp by forcing them to produce toxic uranium powder for his experiments. But Bohr was a civilized man. He now recognized with disgust that Heisenberg, despite his music, his education, his mathematical brilliance, was not. Heisenberg's old teacher, Max Born, being Jewish, could not ride out the war like his pupil. He had to escape Germany. Even at the time of the 1930 conference, the youth groups that Heisenberg relished had been getting stronger. And in the quiet university town of Göttingen, about a third of the adults voted for the Nazi Party in elections that year. One especially energetic student group began working through baptismal records and town registries to see which professors were actually Jewish. Detailed lists were drawn up, and The Jewish Influence in German Universities, Volume 1, University of Göttingen, appeared. Just a few years later, lists like that would be used for extermination. Life became impossible for Born, especially as almost all his faculty colleagues turned away when he tried to get their support. Eventually, he ended up in Scotland, where he became a benevolent teacher of generations of students. His daughter, marrying a British man and taking his last name, Newton John, later moved to Australia, where one of their own children, Olivia, had noted success as a singer and actress. It was a good thing he got away when he did, for during the rise of the Nazi state, it became clear that intellectuals and other prominent Jews were under particular threat. In 1933, when Born was still in Germany, Hitler gained effective control of the Reichstag, and the great number of students who were Nazi supporters could beat up Jews with impunity. Born's daughters were threatened on the street. And then, on May the 10th, in a scene unimagined since the Middle Ages, throughout the country, including the old university towns, great pyres were made of books. The largest book-burning crowds assembled in Berlin at the Opernplatz, just near the Opera House. Students had eagerly been collecting cartloads of volumes seized from libraries or private homes. Propaganda Minister Goebbels arrived at midnight to begin a nationally broadcast speech. "German men and women, you do well in this midnight hour to commit to the flames the evil spirit of the past." Goebbels's photographers were standing by, ready to capture the images that would be shown across the country. The joy before flames, the exultation in the crowds. Student crowds in Göttingen had engaged in their own burnings the same night. Einstein's books had been hurled into the flames with a special glee, for he was the most famous of all Jewish intellectuals and represented a spirit of liberalism and rational inquiry that was the opposite of what the new state insisted was right. "The age of Jewish intellectualism has come to an end," Goebbels announced to the nation from Berlin's Opernplatz. It was easy to tell what was coming. Late in 1932, the year before the Opernplatz rally in which his books would be burned, Einstein had gone to his country home outside Berlin with Elsa, that place of the affairs that had tormented her, of the friendly walks and mushroom hunting and family dinners she had loved, Now they were there to collect his papers, as well as her most important belongings. Caltech in Pasadena, California, had offered him a position, while Princeton's new Institute for Advanced Study in New Jersey looked set to propose a better one. Elsa was good at reading people, but her intuition failed her about what was happening to her country. She and Einstein had gone to America before, for visits or even longer stays when he was a months-long lecturer. Surely this would be just the same. Einstein shook his head. She understood very little. "Look around you," he reportedly said. "It's the last time you'll see this." After Einstein and Elsa had left their home, and after the book burnings the following year, mobs broke in, ransacking what possessions the hated professor had left. Elsa only found out about that later. She was in Belgium at the time, having been under armed protection with her husband before they sailed to America.